Joe Nava, who is the executive officer of the Division of Life Sciences here at the university. He was an 18-year employee of Fish and Game, and he often teaches courses up here through TVCC on bear protection. Also, I have Merritt Helfrich here. He's a longtime Alaskan who's definitely had some close encounters of the strange kind with a few bears. And my special friend and partner, Sam Stoker, who also worked for Fish and Game for a number of years and loves to get out in the bush and has also been up close to a few bears. Who's going to start with their favorite bear story? Merritt.
We're talking about nudists, right?
You've got the topic. Now you determine the direction.
Okay. I had a teddy bear when I was a little kid. Uh-huh. And I had a lot of stories read to me about Pooh Bear. And there was Smokey the Bear. All of these bears were very positive sort of creatures in my life. And I hadn't actually seen any bears until I started off to Alaska in 1958. And the first bear I saw actually out doing things on his own was a bear that crossed the Alaska Highway as I was driving north. He went very rapidly across the highway and disappeared into the woods, but I was very excited. I stopped the car, yelled, and jumped up and down because I'd seen a bear. It was an unusual experience for me. I was very excited about it. The next experience I had personally with a bear was one summer evening in 1959. I and a friend, several friends, were in a local beverage establishment, and we decided at 1 o'clock in the morning it was time to drive to Anchorage. And we drove off down the highway, and it was a beautiful morning. And the sun was just lifting up over the mountains when we got down into the area south of Delta. And there in the middle of the road was an immense, well, I'd never seen a brown bear before, but it was an immense brown bear. And the brown bear looked at the car coming and went into this rather peculiar behavior. It ran back and forth across the road until it finally ran off on one side of the road, ran along the side of the road until it came to a culvert, where it proceeded to stick its head in front quarters into the culvert, but it seemed to be a little big for the culvert. And there it was. Most of the bear had disappeared into the culvert with his hind legs casting about in the air, and scrabbling furiously at the dirt, casting clods of dirt into the air. And I wanted to stop and see whether the bear would actually make it in and go over to maybe the other side of the culvert and yell at the bear that was trying to get in the other side. My wife prevailed on better sense, and I didn't stop, and we sped off into the distance. But I've often wondered what happened to that bear. I've never stopped at the culvert again to see if there's a bear in the culvert or remains of the bear in the culvert.
Just normal curiosity.
Absolutely. Well, no, you seem to be... It's as though he had forgotten something, and he was running off in a hurry to get it.
I think if he was there for a while, he'd lose weight, and then he'd be able to get through.
Yeah, I thought of that, too. But then, on the other hand, maybe he was just trying to attract me to come closer so he could...
entice you into the culvert.
My experiences later got more exciting. But those were my first two experiences.
Okay, well, maybe we should go this way. Joe, could you tell us your first experience, at least the first one you remember with a bear?
Well, it's hard to remember the very first one. I came to Alaska just a couple of years after Merritt did. I drove up the highway with a small family. And I remember just 17 days after I arrived, I first went to Juneau, was hired by Fish and Game, and was stationed in Tok. I arrived in Tok on the 8th of June. 17 days later, this was after driving up over the highway from Massachusetts, 17 days later, my wife told me that it was time to have the next baby, and we drove to the nearest hospital, which was in Glen Allen, 140 miles away. And on the way down to Glen Allen with the four children in the car and the pregnant wife, there was a large moose that ran out in the road in front of us and ran down the road in front of us and slowed us down for about a mile before he finally got off the road. And we made it to the hospital okay, and the baby was born. She's the young lady that owns the Fish and Stuff pet store over in the University Mall today, and I hope she's listening. But then I had to take the four children home and leave the wife and the new baby in the hospital, so I made the 140-mile drive back. And on the way back, we did see a bear. It was a black bear, and not the first one I'd seen because I had seen them before, but this one stood right up on the berm beside the road and looked at us just as if it was a tourist and we were the animals. And we stopped, and the youngsters were really all very thrilled with it. And to see what the bear was really like, I got out, and it was close enough so I could pick up a stone from the side of the road and throw a stone and hit the bear on the back end, at which the black bear ran off into the brush. That's really not what I'd recommend as the proper behavior. And I've learned an awful lot about bears since by working several years for the Fish and Game Department and by working about 15 years as a big game guide working for LNS Outfitters over here in the Alaska Range. And most of my bear experiences and the knowledge that I use with which to teach my bear protection courses come from my guiding experiences and the work with the researchers of the university, being out in the field with them and running into bears there, running into them and running from them.
Everyone hopes to live to tell about their first bear experience. That's sort of part of becoming a sourdough. Sam, what is, maybe not your first, but whatever most memorable first bear encounter?
Well, I think my first experience that really sticks in my mind was soon after I'd gone down to Cape Yakutaga. This was in 1960. And I'd gone to work as a surveyor for Peter Kiewit. They were building a White Alice site at that time at Yakutaga. And we were driving back up to the FAA station at Yakutaga. It's about 2 miles from the White Alice site. And a big brown bear was, this was at night, and this large brown bear was out on the road. And so we were in pickup, and we started essentially chasing the brown bear down the road just to see how fast, in fact, they could run. And we clocked her at 35 miles an hour before she finally went off into the brush, which led me to believe that there's no point in trying to outrun a bear.
No, the best advice I give people is that if you're going to go into bear country, always take someone with you that runs slower than you do.
That's right. That's why I take Sam. Absolutely. Well, my first bear, Sam and I were canoeing, and we're always looking for woolly mammoths. We just think they should pop up everywhere on the landscape. And there was this sort of rusty, golden thing, very furry, curled up on the bank. And I thought it was a woolly mammoth coming out of the permafrost. I was really excited. I was saying, my God, it's a woolly mammoth. Look at the sun. It's red. It's the whole thing. It's live. We can probably clone it. You know, it's going to be wonderful. We'll be famous. And all of a sudden, it shook. The whole thing shook. I thought, it's alive.
It's a live
woolly mammoth. And then I realized it was a bear. And by this point, I thought we were very close. I mean, I thought that we were sort of staring down his nose. Well, of course, wasn't true, but we went to the other side of the river. But it was an amazingly large, powerful presence when you actually see one out in the wild at a fairly...
I thought the bear's reaction was very amusing, actually, because we were probably the first people that it had ever seen. And it was still asleep when we pulled into the gravel bank across the river, and this was only, like maybe 50 yards from the bear. And I got out and banged on the canoe to wake the bear up, and it kind of looked around and finally stood up and looked across the river at this aluminum canoe and two people in yellow raincoats standing there, and the expression was like, oh, my God.
I've seen that expression on bear's faces.
And it watched us for about 30 seconds and then took off through the willows.
They aren't too bright sometimes.
How bright are they?
Bears are very intelligent. They're much more aware of their own habitat and their surroundings than you are. Remember that you're the visitor in their home, and they know every little thing that goes on in their community, and they spot anything new and different in the area, such as you, very quickly. They're really quite a very intelligent animal in their own habitat.
Spot literally by sight or smell?
They spot by sight. Now, the idea is that a bear has very poor eyesight, and that's true in a sense. The bear has to get up fairly close in order to see you well enough to determine what you are, but the bear can spot any movement at a great distance. Any movement attracts his attention, and he can see the movement in the terrain. He can spot caribou moving a half a mile or a mile away. And then he's going to go over there to get closer to discover what it is, either from sight or to go downwind and smell it. But that's one reason why he approaches humans often. He may see you in your yellow raincoat or whatever it is, and he may wonder what it is. He may have to get closer to you, and he may come toward you not aiming to do you any harm, but he just wants to know what you are. He has to get a closer look or a better smell in order to determine what you are. They have very good sense of smell and good eyesight.
Is it true, my understanding, that bears that are more familiar with or have more opportunity for human contact may be more dangerous?
That's absolutely true. And when I teach bear protection, I separate the bears into the wild bears and the campground bears, mm-hmm. and you treat them differently. The campground bears are the ones that have had a close association with humans, and that makes them far more unpredictable than the wild bear. Often the association they've had with humans is good, or at least neutral, and so then they seek another association. And how they act depends on how close the association has been with humans in the past, and you don't know that. That's why campground bears are so dangerous.
Well, in fact, most people, when they think of bears in terms of danger, immediately think of grizzlies. And in fact, most bear attacks are by black bears. Campground bears are just bears that are more familiar with human beings and human habitation.
I once saw some people feeding a brown bear in Yellowstone from the top of a camper. They had a big pile of food on top of the camper, and they were feeding the bear, who was standing on its hind legs. I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen in my life. I wondered what was going to happen when he ran out of food.
Eat the camper.
Yeah. Wouldn't you say that was a rather dangerous thing to do?
That's the mistake, yes, to use the food to get the bear closer so that it will fill up the camera for a picture for the folks back home. That's about the
And then you fill
you
up
do.
The bear.
These are amazingly brave people, because I have seen bears in McKinley. I've seen bears in Yellowstone. They are very different than bears that I have seen out in the wild, and I've seen a couple on camping trips. But I can't imagine having any kind of desire whatsoever to feed them in either situation. I think they're amazingly powerful animals. I can't imagine thinking of them as pets, as domesticated, manageable beings.
They're tremendously powerful, and they're very fast and very agile. The people who are throwing out a sandwich to get them come closer don't realize how swiftly a bear can cover those few yards. They're extremely fast. At a short distance, they're as fast as the fastest racehorse.
Yeah.
We saw a bear tearing up a ground squirrel warrens. What do you call them?
Holes.
Holes. And just absolutely these wild paw strikes and just tremendous mounds of dirt and the whole terrain changed.
Yeah, I've seen them chasing marmots down at Cape Yakutaga, large brown bears, and they were moving rocks that, they must have weighed, 500,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't begin to move one of them. And they were just rolling them over like they were, concrete building blocks.
And good swimmers. What about that bear you saw swimming across? Tell that story.
Well, Charlie Bilderbeck and I were prospecting. This was down in the Gulf of Alaska at the mouth of the Bering River, which is a very broad, extremely powerful river. And I saw a brown bear one night walk out on the spit opposite us. And, the river's got to be a quarter of a mile wide probably at that point. And I thought the bear was just going out to investigate the spit, looking for seals, just carcasses. And it went out to the end of the spit and just marched right off in the water and swam almost directly across the river.
Towards you?
Towards us, yeah. And then walked out on the other bank and off up across the tundra. But it was just an amazing feat for a river of that size and strength.
He said I barely lost any location.
Barely?
Puns are allowed.
Okay, Merritt, tell me a bear story.
Well, I said earlier that bears are sort of stupid, but Joe's right. In fact, I found I was much stupider than the bears. My personal close contact with bears started to come when I was building my house on Astor Dome to the west of Fairbanks, and I decided to live in a tent while I was building a house. And I got a 10-man army Arctic tent, which is a pyramid tent, and my wife and I lived in the tent. I didn't know what a cache really was for. I thought it was kind of interesting thing to put stuff in, but why do you need that? Well, very rapidly found out. Although it didn't seem to do me any good because the bears were learning faster than I was. Moved into the tent, kept the food in the tent, and one morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up to this horrendous scream. And shot bolt upright, I was sleeping in an army sleeping bag, which is a terrible experience in and of itself. And there in the side of the tent was a new hole, and in the hole was a very large black head. And with the scream, the black head went away, and it was peeking, and we were peeking out through the hole and through the tent flaps, and there was no bear there at all. And about 2 or 3 days later, rip in the middle of the night, scream, and leap up out of the sleeping bag.
Who was doing the screaming?
Carla.
Just checking.
Yeah, well, she got very good at it. She hadn't, I don't think I'd ever heard her scream before, but she was a good, solid scream, and it scared the heck out of me.
Luckily, a lighter sleeper than you.
It seemed to scare the bears, too. And this went on for a good portion of the summer.
God she has healthy lungs.
Yeah, well, yes. And if I'd probably taken the food out of the tent, the bears wouldn't have come back. That's why I said the bears were stupid, but I was a lot stupider. And the bears, in fact, beat a path to the door of the tent. I got very used to going in a circle of about 500 feet around the tent and picking up cans of coffee that the bears had bit through and peanut butter jars, and everything except a can of honey, which was in the tent, and they never bothered. I don't know why. As a child, I learned that bears are supposed to eat honey, and I suppose they do, but they didn't
Pooh
like
bear.
Pooh Bear, yeah. He didn't like the honey in the tent. And they also seemed to be really enthralled with soap powder.
And
they would spread it at about a half-inch thick layer all over the bottom of the tent. And there was another thing that they didn't like.
Skate across the floor.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. They'd mix it up with everything else that was in the tent, and so there was this uniform layer. And the bears, when they came to the tent, would never, never go through the tent flaps. They would never go through the same hole they went through before. And every time they tore a hole in the tent, I would take a piece of visqueen and staple it on the hole. So that it got that by the end of the summer, the tent was fairly light and airy, and before it had been fairly dark. It was on a platform, wooden platform. And after this happened a couple of times, I said, I have to get myself a gun. So I went downtown and found a pistol and came back up to the tent with it. And I thought, this is nonsense. I'd probably shoot myself in the foot with it. And so I went to a friend of mine who had a rifle for sale, and I didn't want to spend too much for it, but he had one that was $40. It was a German Mauser in 1917. He said it was a very good action. There's only one problem with it. It was loose in the stock.
What does that mean?
Well, Joe, what's that mean?
Well, it means that the bedding screws are not tightened down tight, or they don't fit right, so that the gun's not very accurate.
No, it wasn't very accurate. In fact, I once set it down on a bench and fired at a target, and it made something like a patter of about 3 feet in 25 feet. It was pretty exciting. It wasn't very good, but, it made a loud noise. And
your first gun?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the first time I actually fired at a bear, the bear was 3 feet outside the tent, and I was peering through some visqueen from an earlier assault on the tent, and I very carefully squeezed the trigger, and the gun went off, and the bear ran away. And there was a very small piece of hair on the ground. I'd missed him. Well, I hadn't missed him. I'd taken off a piece of hair. About a week later, I was sound asleep in the tent, and I heard the familiar scream and leaped up from the sleeping bag and tried to get out in a hurry, thereby somewhat maiming myself in the process, because leaping out of a sleeping bag with a zipper it can do mortal damage to you.
Especially an army issue sleeping bag.
With a metal zipper. It added to my ire. And I looked out at the tent flaps, and there up the hill was this bear sitting there looking at me. Now, if you've ever been in a penny arcade, a place with electronic games, or in an amusement area, so they sometimes have these light guns and a place where you put in a quarter, and, right. and there's a bear on a view in back, and it has two little has little circles on them, and you point the gun at the bear, and if you the light comes out of the gun and hits the bear on one of these circles, the bear turns. Half turn, going wow, and moves off to the side. Well, it was very much like that when I fired at this bear. I very carefully squeezed the trigger, and held the gun steady, and the bear went roar, turned to one side, and then lifted his front paw in the air and sort of waggled it back and forth, as though I'd somehow injured his paw. And as it turned out later, I'd hit him in the finger. It was. so, and when I did, and then at that point, I opened up the tent flaps and shouted at the bear, and the bear ran away. Well, I thought, well, if they're beating a pass to my door, I should put a noose by between two trees and catch. I didn't know very much about this, Joe. You know.
A noose between two trees.
Yeah, and I'll catch the bear when it goes down the path.
Sort of random luck.
Yeah, well, it didn't work at all.
I can imagine.
Well, shortly after this, somebody shot the bear. Nearby, I saw the bear and shot it, and they had it on the lodge front steps, and I had got myself a skinning knife. Of course, I didn't have anything to skin, but now came time for the skinning knife. And the fellows that had shot the bear said, "Go get your skinning knife." So I went and got my skinning knife.
You had the only skinning knife in the neighborhood?
Yes, I did.
There are many people out there in Radioland who are very amused by this story, I know. I can't imagine living in a neighborhood where there's only one skinning knife.
It was that kind of neighborhood, yeah. There are no limits to the stupidity.
First, folks.
So we went up to skin the bear, and somebody who said, well, he knew what to do, took my knife and proceeded to cut his thumb very badly.
That's why there was only one skinning knife in the neighborhood.
Well, the next fellow said, what nonsense, and he picked up the skinning knife and proceeded to start skinning the bear and got fairly well along, and then he cut his thumb. And then I tried it, and I immediately cut my thumb, and we got somebody...
Might as well do it and get it over with.
Somebody told us that we should all go away and he'd take care of it, and he did. Anyhow, so this bear business went on, and because another bear arrived.
Well, naturally, it was a good neighborhood with only one knife.
Well, the culmination of the summer was that at one point, about 3 o'clock in the morning, there was a scream arising immediately from the tent. Hurting oneself on the zipper, trying to get out of the sleeping bag, firing at the bear, and nothing happening, and the bear sort of sitting there. And I lost it. I became a berserker. I had reached the limit of any sort of sense. I hadn't exhibited very much before, but... They had won. So I ran out of the tent flaps with this stupid, useless gun in my hand, screaming at the bear. And the bear started down the hill. Well, you said they go fast. They sure go fast. But I was going fast, too. I chased that bear down the hill, going in huge leaps down the hill, because it's quite steep, through the woods. It's foggy. It's raining a little bit. And here am I, screaming at the top of my lungs, running down the hill after this bear, shouting and carrying on and waving the gun around, and I don't know what I called, until finally he disappeared. And I was some way along down the hill, and it was very, very quiet. And I stopped, and I'm going, and I finally said, well, where's the bear? And it was very, very quiet. And I started looking around me, and there was no noise. And I realized I didn't have any clothes on. And that made me feel very vulnerable. And so I proceeded up the hill walking in spirals with this useless gun in my hand, walking backwards, walking forwards, turning around the whole way back to the tent, and eventually got back there and got myself protected again.
The nakedness probably helped you get in touch with whose territory it really was.
I think so. I'm really glad the bear didn't stop. I don't know what I would have done. I mean, the bear might very well have stopped and turned and come back up at me.
Here you were looking for the bear, and you were the bear.
I was the bear, yes. I think the bear probably realized that the better part of sense was to leave. and
let you continue to go down the hill and shop.
Yeah, I may have gone right by it. I don't know what happened.
Well, there's a lot of noise and bluff, you know. The bears do understand noise and aggression. Mm-hmm. And when you come running out of a tent, yelling and shouting and screaming, they do understand this as aggression.
It was.
That type of noise is a good way to scare off a bear.
Okay, let's just sort of discuss this issue. Before I moved to Alaska, I read Coming Into the Country. Everyone out there is groaning now. And there's a whole long series when he's out in Chicken. Is that where he was?
Eagle.
Right. Sorry, Eagle. And he stays with some friends out in the bush, and he has to return by himself, and he has to go this route, and he has also never fired a gun, and he's extremely nervous the whole time. And he seems to get the advice in Eagle, or at least he says so in the book, that there are the two schools of bear theory in Alaska. One is take the biggest gauge, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
Gun. I'm looking for approval here. Gun, rifle, whatever.
Take a howitzer with you. Yeah.
You take the biggest gauge thing you can, and you take it out there, and you make sure that you can stop the bear if a bear ever decides that he wants you. And then the other theory, the gentle theory, that bears can sense you have a gun on you, somehow mystical intuition, and they're likely to be more aggressive, or perhaps that you're behaving more aggressively because you have a gun. But at any rate, that theory is go out there and be gentle in the forest and maybe take bells, and they won't attack. What is your reaction, Joe, to that?
Well, when I teach bear protection, a class, I teach both protection without firearms and protection with firearms. It's your choice. But I always take a gun with me when I go into bear country, and I look at it like the life preserver in a boat. When I go down to Homer and go out in Kachemak Bay to do some fishing, I won't go without my life preserver. I will probably never have to use it, but it's my confidence to go out there, and I take it with me. The same with the firearm. I take it with me when I go into bear country, and it is my confidence. I don't think the bear will act any different because I have the gun, but it gives me the confidence to go places and do things boldly and without fear. One of the best examples I can think of is when Dr. Anderson and I were visiting the hot springs of southeastern Alaska, and we had to leave the skiff usually every morning and then walk any number of miles to the hot springs, which were various distances inland. This particular day, we had to go 5 miles up from the head of the bay, but we had to walk the beach to get to the head of the bay. And it was early spring. The grass was just coming up. The snow was still in the woods, and the geese and the deer were out on the beach feeding, and lo, there was a big brown bear out there feeding too. Now, the beach was only about 40 yards wide at this point. The only way to get by was for Jim Anderson and I to walk past that bear. I had a firearm with me. If I had not had a firearm with me, we would have turned around, we would have aborted the trip and lost the whole day, and we would have gone back to the skiff. But with the gun, I had the confidence to go forward and yelling ahead in advance and telling the bear that he was on my beach, get off of my beach, yelling and shouting and waving our arms, and he stood up and looked at us a long time, and we finally got to within about 35 or 40 yards of him before he finally decided that he would go off into the woods and climb the snowbank in the woods and let us have the beach, and we were able to go by. After we went by, he came back out on the beach and fed again. That's the type of thing in bear country that I feel confident in doing with a firearm, but I could not do without.
Mm-hmm. Just reduce your odds too much.
Reduces my confidence an awful lot.
Your confidence. All right. All right.
Well, I think usually the casual approach, the gentle approach to bears works, but I don't consider usually to be good enough.
Yeah, that's right. Audience, our number is 474-5044. I welcome you to call in with your favorite bear stories or with questions for our expert, Joe Nava. 474-5044. Any curious stories that you've had, I'm sure we'd like to hear. Sam, I want you to tell a story about the time you were on a scientific trip and you're out in the field, and you had several tents, and you thought someone was trying to wake you up.
This was off on Cook Inlet, Chinitna Bay. It's over on the west side of Cook Inlet. That was a number of years back. I was with the University Museum at that time, and we were doing an archaeological survey of Chinitna Bay. And we had, I think, five or six small tents that we set up, and sleeping tents. And everyone set up their tent on the beach except myself. And I got to thinking that there are bound to be a lot of bears over here, and that any bear that's kind of patrolling the territory is going to come right down the beach. So I kind of moved mine back off into the woods just a very short distance. Well, it turned out my whole idea backfired, because the bears, in fact, came down the beach to within sight of the tents and then detoured through the woods.
Through your
and
tent.
Right through my tent. And I woke up one morning. One of the other people was yelling at me to get up. And it was light pretty much 24 hours at that time. And I wasn't sure what time it was, and I kind of rolled over. It didn't seem like I'd slept very long. I looked at my watch, and it was like 4:30 in the morning. And I thought, I'm not getting up at 4:30 in the morning. And the person kept on yelling at me, and I tried to go back to sleep, and was about half asleep. And someone started kind of shaking the tent and pushing against my head. And I thought it was Bill Sevich who had been doing the yelling. And I thought, I'm not going to get up, man. And I turned around and backhanded him and yelled something, which I probably shouldn't repeat. And it turned out it wasn't Sevich at all. It was a black bear with her head stuck in the tent. And he'd seen the bear and was yelling at me to try to wake me up to alert me to it. Well, it turned out the place was absolutely alive with bears. There were at least half a dozen black bears that were residing in that close vicinity. And they discovered right away that we had quite a bit of food in the cook tent. So every night they would raid the cook tent. And actually, they were quite neat and orderly for black bears. They would usually just pick up a few things and go off with them. And we had tin cans tied up to the entrance of the tent, and, you know, hoping to scare them off.
Didn't do a
bit of good. And finally, when we left, when the plane came in to pick us up, well, we were all loading everything, taking down the tents. And the black bears, three of them, a mother and two pretty full-grown cubs, were watching this with great dismay. And they came
there
down
goes dinner.
Within about 50 feet and were standing up in the brush like, oh, no, you're not leaving, are you?
When, Joe, when you have been out in the bush, have you ever had any experiences where there seemed to be at least some kind of acceptance of the situation between bears and the camps you were in, or?
An acceptance of the situation?
Well, as this, Sam, describing that there was some kind of equitable arrangement there. Mostly I hear about people whose cabins are absolutely demolished in a very short time. Maybe actually we should talk about the kind of elaborate things you've heard of that people do to keep bears out of their camps and cabins.
Well, there are all sorts of things that they do, like hanging cans on the door, shuttering the windows, putting hardware cloth over the windows, driving spikes through the door.
Doesn't work, does it?
Putting poles up in front of the door, even putting mothballs around is one that they all are something nice to try, but the bear is very clever, and I haven't seen anything that's 100% foolproof if a bear decides to get into your cabin. I've been in the cabins out in the woods. I was moose hunting one night and sleeping in a cabin, an old cabin, by the way, a very old cabin built back in the 20s when a grizzly came around and spooked the horses, and we heard it, and it came and sniffed around the cabin, and you could hear it moving around the cabin and sniffing through the logs and the holes where the ground squirrels had been through. And then it tore the shed door off the front of the cabin. It was a cabin with a shed built on the front of it. Tore the pole door off of the front of the shed, came in and took a hind quarter of moose meat, one that was hanging in the shed, tied up with rope, by the way, and just pulled it and broke the rope right off of the lodge pole, shook the whole cabin, and then walked off that night. And I have no doubt that if that bear wanted to, it would have come right through the door of the cabin and come on in, where we would have been ready for it with a gun, by the way. But if they want to get into a cabin, it's very difficult to keep them out, and they can really make a mess.
They're extremely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Nails are not a deterrent. Nails, boards and nails are not enough to do it. Sort of buff, like buffalo not being respecters of fences.
Right. The buffalo brings up an interesting story that just popped into my mind. When I was a game biologist in Tok, I worked on the bison herd in Delta, and I used to go down and watch them in the dump at Fort Greeley at night. It was fairly light at night, and I'd go down and watch them in the fall. And I had colored streamers on their ears, and I was checking what bison went where and who did the damage and which fields and so forth. One night there was a big bull bison that came and walked down into the dump, and he was standing among the tin cans when a grizzly bear came out of the woods and across the road and looked down into the dump and saw the bison, paid no attention, and started walking down into the dump. And as soon as he hit the cans, he made a lot of noise walking, and it scared the bison. The bison looked and saw him and then ran right out the other side of the dump and up into the woods on the other side. It was only about 5 or 10 minutes later the bison came back, looked down into the dump and saw the big grizzly down there feeding in the dump, and the bison watched it for a few minutes, and then the bison decided to walk right down into the dump. When the bison got down into the tin cans and started making some noise, the grizzly looked up and ran right out of the dump and off into the woods. He was frightened by this bison coming toward him. Well, sure enough, it was about 10 minutes later, the bison was frightened by the bear coming toward him. And they went back and forth at least 6 or 8 times that night, and I had a marvelous show.
All the noise making that was going on.
That's right. It was the advancing of one animal that frightened the other animal and made them walk away. But then when there was no further threat, they decided to come back.
Our number is 474-5044 if you have any bear stories you'd like to share or questions that you'd like to ask, because this is, in a way, time that people are thinking about getting out. Tell us about bears and their hibernating patterns. They are not total hibernators.
No, they're not true hibernators. They just go in for a deep sleep and wake up occasionally in the wintertime. But they're out now. They come out early. They come out in early April around here. And they generally come off the hills. They'll lay on the south-facing slopes a little bit in the early part of the year, and then they'll start moving now down onto the flats, because down in the flats is where the first bits of green are going to come up, and that's what they will go down and feed on. So the black bears around here particularly will be moving down onto the flats. If you want to hunt them early in the year, hunt them with a boat along the river bottoms. Just one mention back to firearms. We did talk about firearms with bears, and I do want to mention and stress that Merritt made a good point about firearms. It's a wise thing to do to decide to use a firearm to protect yourself from bears, but the responsibility is yours when you do to learn to use it properly and know what you've got and know how to use it and not misuse it, or you're apt to be very damaging to yourself. The biggest gun in the world isn't going to do you much good if you're just hitting the bear in the toe.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about what kind of guns will stop a bear. What kind of guns should you not use expecting to protect yourself from bears? Or what guns should you use?
It's not just a point of deciding which gun will stop a bear, because I've killed two bison down in Delta, one with a .44 Magnum pistol and one with a .357 Magnum pistol, both perfectly adequate. I've killed a black bear with a .357. I've killed a moose with a .357. I've killed a caribou with a 9mm. They are guns, handguns of .357 Magnum or larger are adequate to do the job. Shotgun, a 12-gauge shotgun is the best for close range. Any large rifle is good, but at close range, the shotgun is probably the best. But what you have to remember is that all of these guns have advantages and disadvantages. The handgun being the least powerful of the three that I've mentioned, but the easiest to carry and the most handy. And so when I talk about guns for bear protection, I talk about the 12-gauge shotgun if you want the best that you can carry for close range. And I talk about a good compromise is a .357 Magnum, because you can practice with it and you can learn to shoot it well, and it is adequate if you do have to shoot the bear. Part of my course, though, is teaching you when to shoot the bear, which is only when it's very close.
I know. I've had this lesson, you know, wait till da-da-da-da-da. And I'm going, fine. I mean, this makes sense to me when we're in a gravel pit and I'm there with a gun, which I've only fired a gun 6 times. I do it once every year before we go out into the bush. So just, I don't know, it just seems like some kind of a fire drill in school that you knew was not going to help you when the real fire came. And that's the way I feel about, you know, me and guns and bears. We have some calls. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a couple of questions about the legality of shooting a bear.
Okay.
One is, under what circumstances is it legal to shoot a bear? And also, what are the laws concerning salvaging the meat, hide, or whatever?
Okay,
the law is that you are perfectly legal to shoot a bear anytime you do it for self-protection. The law requires that you try all other means first. You only shoot the bear as a last resort. But you are perfectly legal to shoot the bear as a last resort for protection. If you do this for protection, you do not have a hunting license, you're not shooting it as a hunt, you're not hunting it, then you're required to report it to Fish and Game, give them a written report, and you're required to salvage the meat and the skull from the bear and turn that over to Fish and Game also. So you can't just shoot it and leave it lay. You must shoot it, salvage it, and notify Fish and Game.
Uh-huh. And for instance, if it's getting into a cache, it's not a danger to myself. Can I legally shoot it?
It doesn't have to be a danger to yourself. It can be a threat to you or your property. It could be about to kill your dog that's tied up on your property, and you would be legal. There again, though, you must try everything else possible first, shoot it as a last resort, but yes, you can shoot it to protect your property as well as yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Okay, to begin with, Sam said that most people are worried about grizzly attacks, but most black bear, bear attacks are black bears. I don't think I've ever heard of a fatal incident involving a black bear. Deaths from bear attacks that I know about are grizzlies. I wonder if he knows of any fatal black bear attacks.
Personally, I know of at least three black bear fatalities in interior Alaska within the last 10 years or so.
Okay. Then Joe was talking about the time that he was aware of the bear entering the cook tent because wherever he had the moose hanging because the horses were spooked. And I wonder if grizzlies ever kill horses. I know they can kill some pretty good-sized grizzlies and moose.
Well, I'd like to take a shot at that because I've been hunting with horses in the Alaska Range for so many years, and we've never had a grizzly kill a horse out there. As a matter of fact, I've let my young teenage daughters wander around those hills a lot by themselves, and as long as they have their horses with them, the horse is a very good protection against the bear because the horse will always detect the bear long before you do and let you know that the bear is there, and the horse will run, flee, and carry you away from the grizzly. But no, I have never seen a grizzly attack a horse. I've seen the opportunity. I came back into camp one night, and my pack horse was picketed in the willows right by the camp. And there was a large grizzly tearing up my tent camp at the time I came back into camp. And it did a very thorough job of tearing up all the sleeping bags, tearing the packs apart, and really messing up that camp. But it had never bothered the horse. The horse was there only about 20 yards away, and the horse was just wide-eyed and right at the end of its picket rope, but there were no tracks over there to the horse. The bear had not paid any attention to that picketed horse at all. The horses do spook fiercely, but we've never had any trouble. I've been chased by a grizzly when I was on a horse, but only because I came out of the willows and surprised the bear very close, and the bear made a rush at me. As soon as my horse turned and ran back through the willows, then the bear was perfectly happy to go the other way through the willows. But that wasn't the bear trying to get the horse. That was the bear being surprised and having to make a charge in self-defense. I have never run into a case of where the grizzly would try to take the horse. difference. I have never run into a case of where the grizzly would try to take the horse.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And just as a point of information, Merritt should be informed that his Delta Junction bear could not have been a brown bear because it's too far from tidewater, right? And then
I'm not gonna bet on anything that night.
You thought the tide was telling you, but
may have even been a dog, but I thought it was a bear.
Okay. Somebody might want to talk about 1963. I think was the year that that bears were wandering all around town. Almost anybody who was around Fairbanks in 1963 had some kind of bear story. They were walking through the family quarters at Eielson and walking through South Fairbanks. I'm going to get hang up
fine
now, but I thought that's something that might have
jarred their memories.
Come up.
Yeah,
right.
Good. Thank you. We'll let you hang up and we'll talk about 1963. You remember that year?
I do remember 1963 very well. I was working for Fish and Game at the time, and it was a year of very high black bear population and a very poor blueberry crop. And the black bears were everywhere, and they were looking for something to eat. And that's a year when I investigated 5 unprovoked attacks on humans by black bear, one of which resulted in a death. That was Mr. Strandberg out there north of Manly, who was killed and partially eaten by a black bear. That was the year that the bears were so thick in Manly that there were 24 black bears killed within what they call the city limits of Manly, and the ladies got together and formed a firearms patrol, and whenever they went berry picking, they always went in a group, and some of them always stood guard with firearms while the rest of them picked berries. It was that serious that year.
My goodness. Is that the year that you were working?
Oh, with Fish and Game?
Mm-hmm.
No, I remember I believe it was 67, there was a similar situation existed up in the Circle Central District, when there seemed to be a very high bear population, and the berry crop wasn't good. And they'd killed a camper in the campground just outside of Circle Hot Springs. And we happened to be up there. I was on a research crew. And Johnny Beardall at that time ran the lodge, and he had an old 25-20 rifle, which he had the good sense to not use. But the bears were literally running him out of business, and he asked if we could do something about the bears. Plus, like I said, just a week or so before, they'd killed a camper. And in the space of about 20 minutes, in fact, it was less than 20 minutes, I ended up shooting 4 black bears within a 50-yard radius of Beardall's lodge.
Joe, was the caller's comment about there not being a brown bear down by Donnelly, did that make sense?
Well, it does make sense because he's differentiating between the brown bear and the grizzly bear, as some people do. You know, if you're going to put a bear in the Boone and Crockett Club records, they say that close to the coast, beyond this line, we'll call them brown bears, and then in the interior, we'll call them grizzly bears.
So I probably saw a grizzly.
If you want to differentiate between the two, yes, you
what
saw
is
a
the
grizzly.
Difference?
They have decided, I believe, that they're the same species, actually, now.
Well, they have, you're right, and it's because they grade into the what is called the brown bear on the coast, the
right.
Kodiak bear or the brown bear down there. They slowly grade into what we have up here at the interior, the grizzly. And nowhere can you draw a line and say everything on the one side is a grizzly and everything on the other side is a brown. If you take one grizzly from the interior and compare it to a brown down on the coast, you will see a great difference, and that's why people differentiate between the two.
I see.
In fact, I believe initially the North American bears were described by a man by the name of Merriam, I believe that he came up with something like 50 species initially of North American bears, which has gradually gotten down to 3, which is probably what it should be.
How many?
I believe there were 50 initially, so 50-some.
Well, he was a splitter. Some taxonomists are splitters, and they like to split everything into little tiny small groups and give them different names.
Every slight differentiation,
right.
Different colored ears would be a new species. Our number is 474-5044. 474-5044 if you have some final comments to share, dear audience? Yes, Merritt.
Joe, I remember that the glacier bears, were figured to be a different species at one time, but apparently it's just a color variation on a black.
That's right. It's a color phase of the black bear, yes. Yeah.
You were talking about interaction between human beings and animals and bears, and I had a marvelous experience outside my house one time with my stupid dog that you may remember, Sam. It was called Heifetz. Heifetz was a cross between a standard poodle and a Labrador, and a very strange dog. And one night I was asleep in the summer, and I heard the dog barking outside, and the dog's pitch got higher and higher, and the frequency of the dog's bark got more and more rapid. And I thought, what the devil's going on? And I went down the stairs, and I opened up the front door, and as I did so, the dog fell practically onto my feet. It had been plastered up against the door, and something was obviously wrong. And I looked down at the dog who ran around behind me, and I looked out the door, and there right off the edge of the porch was a medium-sized to large black bear. And I looked at the black bear, and the black bear looked at me. And at that point, I think in order to tell the story, I have to sort of anthropomorphize it because I don't know what they were doing. But the dog, you know, suddenly came to the thought, well, I'm the dog, and I have to protect the house and the person. And so the dog, from his earlier stance of trying to get as far away from the bear, went running out past me and out off the porch and down the hill towards the bear, going just like crazy. And the bear sort of looked up at the dog coming, screaming down the hill at the bear, and he turned around and started running down the hill. And then you could sort of see something happen to the bear saying, you know, why am I doing this? And the bear stopped and turned around, and the dog, seeing the bear turn around, put out its front paws into a standard sort of screeching stop with leaves flying every which way, and came to a stop and started up the hill. And the bear started up the hill after the dog. And the dog ran right up the hill, ran around the porch, came running in past me, almost knocking me over to get in behind me, panting like crazy. And the bear stopped where it was originally and looked at me, and I looked at the bear, and the bear looked at me, and I said, goodnight, bear, and closed the door.
Sounds like a Roadrunner cartoon.
Yeah.
It sounds fairly typical. It sounds like the classical example. That's why they say that you shouldn't take loose dogs into bear country, because
they'll bring them back to you.
Yeah, even though they will warn you that there's a bear around, they just might bring the bear right back to you. A tethered dog is all right because the dog will bark and let you know that a bear is around. But a loose dog, unless it's a very wise bear dog, it's just apt to get you in trouble, as Merritt's did.
We saw a funny incident like that. We were coming back from Manly one night. And remember, Sam, that...
Oh, yeah.
Well,
you
tell the story about that truck passing us with the...
Well, we were driving back from Manly Hot Springs, and a pickup truck with a number of dogs in the back passed us at one point. And several miles down the road, we came upon a pickup driving fairly slowly, and I could see all the dogs out in front of it, running in front of the pickup. And I thought, that's very strange that they should haul these dogs out here, you know, 20 miles from town to exercise them. And then I looked at the lead dog and thought, that's a very large lead dog. Well, it was a black bear, but all of the dogs had jumped out of the truck and was chasing this bear down the road. And the bear finally went off in the brush, and the guy stopped and was screaming at the dogs. And
this guy was going berserk in his car, screaming at his dogs, you know, just terrified that they were actually going to catch up with the bear. You know, it's just a hopeless situation. There's nothing you can do except to try and keep pace. Do you have any final things that we should make sure that people know about bears and bear safety here? We can continue to tell bear stories, but I just want to make sure that we've made all the important point so we don't mislead anyone.
No, the only thing I say that's important is that when you go out into bear country, remember that it's the bear's country, and wherever possible, you want to back out of the way from any confrontation and leave that country to the bear. Always try to let the bear know you're coming so that the bear can avoid you if he wants to, but if you do see a bear, it's best for you to back off and let the bear have his territory. Don't force it. And if you do decide that you'd like to carry a firearm for confidence, you have the responsibility to learn to use it safely and well, or you shouldn't be out there with it. You're more of a hazard with the firearm than you are in the face of the bear.
And I did want to mention that you teach, in fact, a course for adult women in the use of the handgun.
Yes, I do. A beginning course for adult women in the use of the handgun, yes.
And you teach that through TVCC?
No, I've been teaching that through the Tenino Valley Sportsmen's Association. I teach the bear protection through TVCC. But if anyone wants to call me, I'd give them the particulars or sign them up for my next ladies' beginning handgun course.
Okay, what is the number?
My home number is 479-2340.
So for anybody, any women who want some experience using a handgun, handguns terrify me. That's, you know, I just want a big shotgun.
Sounds like you're a great candidate for my course.
Yes, that's quite possible. I just holding them makes me nervous. Actually, I just grew up in a family that didn't have guns, and
that's what the course is for. It will take that fear away from you and give you the confidence to use it as any other tool if you choose to.
You have to be careful, Joe, I know. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. In fact, I know a story about two people who were down in the Solsha, and there had been a lot of bears around. And so they set up their sleeping arrangement at night, and they were quite concerned about it, and one of the fellows had a .357 Magnum handgun. And he kept it very close to him. And they were worried about rain, too, so they set up a shelter half across a couple of posts over top of their two sleeping bags. And during the night, the one fellow woke up, and he knew something was wrong. And he looked off between he and the other fellow, and here was this big black shape. And he whipped up the handgun and fired immediately at the black shape. And it was completely drenched in water. What had happened is it had rained, and the shelter half had filled up with water and made a big bulge between he and his friend. And so when he shot through it, he was drowned. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's all part of being sure of your target before you shoot.
Absolutely.
And you can really scare yourself out there. You're out camping in a strange place. It's dark. You're nervous anyway. I mean, the first thing every time I talk to someone outside who has no firsthand experience with Alaska, they always seem to say there's bears up there, as if that's the most distinguishing feature of this country.
There's a lot of space between the bears.
It is. How much space does an average bear need?
Well, it depends on the bear. You know, some of them, the grizzlies on the North Slope, may be traveling a 25-mile home range or more, and some of the more closely crowded black bears may only be traveling 5 to 10 miles for a home range. It just depends on where they are and where the food and cover is and how crowded they are by other bears. They'll go as far as they have to go to get the food and whatever else they need, the cover, for their home range.
But they have a home range, sort of loosely defined home range?
They have a home range that's fairly well defined by the other bears in the area. Because as soon as they wander into somebody else's home range, he's going to say, hey, what are you doing over here? And they'll talk about it and they'll settle their boundary differences somehow.
And, yes, right. But not with fatal combat, more threatening gestures?
No,
and
that's what
posturing.
It is. That's what I was saying earlier, where the bear recognizes aggression. It's the bear that will either stand up the tallest or growl the loudest or make the most aggressive move that will drive the other bear off. They understand aggression.
That bear I was chasing, though, Joe, had he felt cornered, might have turned around, right?
Had he felt cornered, he might. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yes.
And I could have been in deep trouble.
Yep. But they do understand the false charge, too. You know, anytime you come upon them close, there is a false charge. I mentioned one that charged me, and there was a graduate student that I know that was charged by a bear because she surprised it at only about 15 or 20 feet in the willows. And as soon as she surprised it, it charged her. But it didn't come all the way to her. It made a quick 90-degree turn and disappeared into the willows. She, of course, was going backwards as fast as she could and screaming, and it did the job. It set her off balance. And she was then no threat to the bear, and that's what he intended.
What about rolling into a tight little ball? Is that the way to do it?
That's only if you get hit. Uh-huh. You don't roll into a tight ball before you get hit. You stand up and face the bear. You never turn your back on the bear. You never run away from a bear, because that's just saying, here I am, you can come and catch me if you want to. I'm afraid of you. You stand and face the bear, back up if you want to, but always face the bear and don't ever drop and curl up into the fetal position unless you've been hit. If the bear hits you, then you curl up in the fetal position and protect the back of your neck with your hands and play dead, but only after you've been hit.
Actually, in terms of the number of human bear encounters in the interior, are we at great risk?
No, of course. You're at more risk in your car, or you're also at more risk of being bitten by a dog than a bear. It's a very desperate thing when it happens, but it's actually a very low occurrence in this state.
Well, we'll all rest easier tonight knowing that. I thank my guests, Joe Nava, Merritt Helfrich, Sam Stoker. I almost made it tonight all the way through. My thanks to our executive producer, Carla Tonella. I'm Patty Kostelic. Have a nice week.
You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and we will now continue on with this Saturday evening with a Prairie Home Companion.